Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, November 6, 2008. And I will be going pretty much right into the science topic this week, continuing once again with the... I'm getting some background noise at the tower there. At any rate, the main science topic, continuing with the topic of a large celestial object coming by a planet, something like Earth. So this is somewhat hypothetical, but also relating to things that have happened in the past. And, of course, last week I read from a number of the ancient books talking about the effects that have occurred in the past. So I'll go right into that. A quick couple of announcements, however. Of course, the election is over, and I'm sure we're all glad of that. I found it interesting just to relay, I don't know how many people see international reaction, but apparently there was a great deal of euphoria that the Bush era has hopefully ended. This is according to international sources pretty much all over the world, the irrationality and the strange, bizarre behavior and foreign policy that the U.S. has maintained. And trying to, let's say, have a more rational approach towards the other countries of the world. And, of course, I've lived in many different countries of the world, so I see the United States through the eyes of the people in the other country. So, and that's something most Americans cannot do. They may have gone on vacation to a foreign country, but never really lived amongst the people. Whether they're the wealthy people of the country or the poorest people of the country, I've lived amongst all of them. So I have a very different view of how the United States is looked at around the world. So at any rate, enough of that. Time will tell. But there's no mistaking that the U.S. is now somewhat viewed as a third world country. Because of the collapse of the dollar, etc. So the future is going to be very interesting, let's put it that way. But the United States is certainly not going to be held in the same esteem it was a few short years ago. There is currently a hurricane moving across the Midwest, and it is centered around the state of South Dakota. And the arm that swings out of this hurricane, of course, that's a term I defined in my weather book and with my weather work, a hurricane being a hurricane that is over land. One of the arms swings all the way down to northern Mexico. And of course, all of the people in this path are feeling the effects of this early winter hurricane. The other day, Puerto Rico experienced about a 5.0 earthquake, and just a little explanation here, the Puerto Rican Trench lies off the coast of Puerto Rico, and it is one of the deepest unexplored trenches in the world. It's underwater, under the ocean, and about 11 times per day, this trench slips along the plate boundary there and causes small mini earthquakes. And if you've ever been in the tropical Caribbean islands, any of the chains down there, you feel the effects of this large plate slippage every day. About 11 earthquakes per day, but they're very small. It's like all of a sudden you'll be sitting, doing whatever you're doing, or standing, and all of a sudden the ground will just shake just a little and then stop. Very small earthquakes. But that is good, because that means that the energy that's stored in those plates is relaxing continually. It's continually slipping, rather than some of the plates in the world which build up and build up and build up. They're under a lot more pressure, apparently. And when they slip in a tremendously big way. So it's actually good that Puerto Rico and that region has many small earthquakes. And this is still a remnant of the event of probably about 4,000 or 5,000 years ago when a large comet came through our solar system and, in fact, ravaged this part of the solar system, including Earth. And, of course, that's the topic of the main science topic that I've been covering for a number of weeks. And I'm going to start getting away from the gravitational effects. I spent a great deal of time going into detail on the gravitational effects because the gravitational effects are not well known, let's put it that way. You can read Velikovsky, you can read the Kolbrin, the Oralinda, all of these ancient texts, and I can see this in my own mind's eye because I understand the physics. But once I began this series, I realized that the general public really doesn't have a good understanding of the gravitational effects. Now, understand that gravity works through all of the electromagnetic effects that are going on, and gravity is a very different force. It is not shielded. People talk about anti-gravity or anti-gravity devices, and in reality, what those really are, they have to do with different types of forces. For example, balancing gravity with electromagnetic forces. Gravity works through our ionosphere, it works through electromagnetic shielding, and so gravity is a very different force. It's not affected by shielding. When you have electrical and magnetic effects in outer space or in plasma physics, shielding is something that happens almost automatically, it happens naturally, but gravity is not like that. So all of the gravitational effects that I was describing in prior weeks, it works through the plasma shielding, the sheaths that surround, for example, large comets. So at any rate, that's kind of a subtle, possibly esoteric topic, but it's very important because the... just a second, I have to stop here. On Tower 3, I'm getting a lot of feedback noise in my headset here from the station. So if you could tone that down, I would appreciate it. At any rate, on to the main science topic here. I just want to remind everybody that this show is heard not only at this time on 5070 Tower 3 at WWCR, also on the live streaming, but also 2 hours later it is aired on the internet streaming at realityradionetwork.com, and then Friday night also on a different frequency, also out of WWCR, 5.890. And the times for that, Friday night, 10 p.m. Central Time, and 3 a.m. Saturday morning, that's once again at frequency 5.890 megahertz. It is also on XM Radio at both of those times, and of course, it is also has streaming on WWCR.com. So those are the different times and places this show airs every week. Now, I just want to remind you, the first thing I wanted to remind you of as going into this fifth week of this topic on the conditions, the effects of a large celestial object coming by, is that there are many Planet X-type objects out there. Not just one. There's so much emphasis placed on Planet X that a lot of people think, well, there's just one, and if it came by then missed us, then we'd be past the danger zone, so to speak. And that's really not true. Earth as a planet and all of the other planets have had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of close encounters with celestial objects coming through the solar system in their history. the many, many mountain-building epochs of Earth, the many mass extinctions of Earth, some major, some minor, are primarily due to objects passing through the solar system and not necessarily asteroidal collisions, as is portrayed in the popular media. The many, many effects, the one thing I've been trying to do in past weeks is to explain that sometimes these encounters are not very serious. Sometimes they are extremely serious, and there's a myriad of factors that affect the overall outcome. Let me use an example here. Before I talked about how close an object would come, how fast it would be moving by the Earth, and the relative effects based on those factors. Also, how big is this object? Is it more massive than the Earth? Is it less massive than the Earth? That, of course, has effects on our atmosphere. Are we going to have a pollution event? Are we going to drain material out of that large comet tail? Or is that object going to pull on our atmosphere and pull it away? If the surface gravity of the object is much larger than Earth's, then it would tend to pull away our atmosphere and we would tend to lose our oceans. But these rebuild over time. They come back. The solar system is constantly replenishing our oceans and our atmosphere. They're constantly building up over time. So over the long term, Earth recovers and comes back and then goes through the new evolutionary cycle. And this is a way of bringing about growth. Now, if you had a stagnant planet that just sat there and there were none of these epic times when there was radical change, quick radical change, then evolution would really not go very far. It really wouldn't produce very much. So these are required changes to produce the kind of effects, the long-term effects, and eventually get up to intelligent life. And we see this, we actually see this in the evolutionary chains, but there is a grand plan to the working of both biological systems in this solar system structure that we live in the galaxy. And one of the major contributors is the fact that these celestial objects do come through the solar system, they do cause radical change, and out of that change comes a whole new epoch of growth and rebuilding. So, at any rate, I just wanted to clarify and reiterate that there are many Planet X type objects out there, not just one. And, of course, I said also that NASA has now admitted this publicly, and has admitted that they have search programs that are underway, and they have new search programs that are coming online to search for these very objects. And their statement was that they have discovered maybe less than 1% of them, maybe less than 0.1% of them. And of course, that means that they don't know how many are out there, how big they are, what their orbits are, if their orbits will bring them into the inner solar system. So Earth has been affected by many of these objects in the past, and we don't have a good history of this. So I want to just dispel the myth, the rumor, the disinformation that there is just one Planet X object. And that was part of that 2003 May 15th disinformation campaign that, oh, it didn't come, so there is no Planet X, and it's just something goofy. And it was a very well-orchestrated disinformation campaign, but it kind of backfired, and I think now people are far more aware, number one, of the disinformation, and number two, that Planet X and the many Planet X objects, as I call them, are very real. So this week I want to start out just by noting my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes, the supplemental pamphlet called Surviving Planet X Passage. Once again, on page 34 and 35, I have a couple diagrams that illustrate how the pole shifts work. when an object comes by. And basically, the mantle and crust of the Earth sit on a very viscous layer around the core being the denser, central, round part of the Earth. And when one of these objects comes by, the core and the mantle tend to slip one against one another, and the mantle then changes relative position. So what used to be the North Pole is now moved down, let's say, 20 or 30 degrees. And then, guess what? That North Polar Cap that used to be there all of a sudden very quickly melts. And we see these kind of glacial, very rapid melt situations. We see them all over Earth. We see them out in the state of Oregon and Washington. We see them in Alaska. We see them in the upper Midwest, where the Great Laurentian Ice Cap melted and washed out the Mississippi River Valley. This is very obvious if you look at the upper part of the Mississippi River Valley, which I have explored extensively. Now, I want to challenge everybody out there to find something near where they live. Just look at even if it's a hill, even if it's a plain, if it's a water lake structure, or if it's a shoreline, look for the evidence of massive destruction in the Earth's past. I was just looking this past week through some pictures in a tourist magazine of Italy, one of the tourist places, and they were talking about one of the quaint little ocean villages. And lo and behold, there on the coastline, the Earth had been thrust up so that the layers of the Earth, which had layered down over millions of years, those layers were thrust up perpendicular so you could see what used to be flat was now vertical. What used to be horizontal was now vertical. And these layers, of course, were eroding away with the rain and the tidal action of the ocean. And these towns were built on this rock structure. So at some point in Earth's history, that land that was once under the ocean was thrust up. As I said, the horizontal layers were now completely vertical. There's an island up in Lake Superior, and much of the coastline going over to Michigan in Lake Superior, there's an island that is actually part of the state of Michigan called Isle Royale. And it too is exactly like that, where the horizontal layers that were built up underwater, the sedimentary layers, are vertical. And so a tremendous shockwave hit Earth at one point. And that's just one little local place. So the Earth, I would challenge you all to go out and just as you're driving around, if you're driving on roads, many times roads are excavated through a hillside, and you can see these vast earth-changing events that happened in the past to cause the ripples in the horizontal layers. They're smashed or compressed or stretched or broken. And I would challenge that anybody, no matter where you are in the world, can find the remnants of these effects. So, for example, the Himalayan mountains were probably built during a tremendous celestial encounter long ago, very long ago in Earth's history. And then as the following epochs of celestial objects passing by came along, the Rocky Mountains, the Andes, the Himalayas, then had many epochs of mountain building built on top of them, and you can actually, if you understand what to look for, you can see these mountain building epochs. So this is the gravitational effects along with the pole shift, and as that pole shifts, our calendar changes. Now, what's interesting is when Velikovsky first started his studies, the thing I always want to impress on people is that he was studying calendars. He was trying to find timeline events in ancient history around the world, the various historical writings that came from all over the world. He was looking for a timeline so he could associate different empires and dynasties around the world to a single timeline and then go forward and backwards. And this is something that had nothing to do with astronomy or geology or any of the other topics that he eventually became associated with. So Velikovsky was studying calendars and tripped upon this view that came from all parts of the world, that Venus was once a large comet. It came through the solar system, ravaged Earth. And, of course, the astronomical community primarily raised up a tremendous objection because it did not fit into their view of the world. They thought everything happened slowly, that Earth was here by itself, and that nothing had ever affected Earth from the beginning of time. And I find it almost rather comical that lately I've seen even NASA scientists now wondering if possibly some of the moons of Saturn could have at one time been large comets. And so it's interesting to see what I call the creeping crud, where the mainstream scientists are starting to ask the questions, but they just can't cross that barrier. They can't get away from the idea that comets are dirty snowballs or that they are very electrical in nature. So on to a couple of topics here. Imagine, let's look at the structure of a comet. Now, for the past weeks, in the beginning of this show, I've talked about gravitational effects. So buried deep in that large comet coma is a nucleus. Most comets are small. Statistically, most comet nuclei are very small. Some of them maybe a few hundred feet across, a quarter mile across, 7 miles across, something like that, relatively small. Modern science would consider a nucleus 20 miles across to be fairly large. But this is a statistical low end, you might say, to the number of objects that are floating around the universe and the galaxy and our solar system. The sun obviously has associated with it many, many objects, some of them extremely large. And so these are the ones that I want to concentrate on. Now, when any object, whether it's a dust grain, whether it's something the size of a baseball, whether it's something the size of the moon, or something the size of Earth, or something the size of Jupiter, no matter what this object might be or how large it is, if they come into our solar system on an elliptical orbit, they are going to break that capacitor, the solar capacitor, and discharge it and become a comet. So the other thing I want to dispel, and I say this over and over, you've heard me say this a million times if I've said it once, that when you see one of these large objects, by the time you see it, it will be in the form of a comet. All of the disinformation ploys that are out there, all of them, want you to think that a Planet X object is some kind of big orange ball. So the one key that I give people, if you see a book that claims to be authoritative on the topic of either the Colburn or Planet X or whatever, if it has a big orange ball on it, then you know that this came out of the disinformation, let's say, printing press. If you see something on YouTube, if you see something on the Discovery Channel, if you see that big orange ball, the thing they want to leave you is that visual impression that a Planet X object in the solar system would be something big and orange and round, which is really absolutely false. What you would see is a large raging comet, a plasma discharge comet. And what happens, as explained in my books, you can read these, but basically the comet forms around the nucleus. The material is being drawn into the comet nucleus and by strong electrical forces. And this is where the electrical nature of comets comes in. But what I want to concentrate on tonight is we all know what a comet looks like. It's that like large, fuzzy. Some of them are round in shape, like the certain comets that we've seen recently, but some will have a very long tail, like Comet Hale-Bopp. We could see that up in the night sky for months and months back in the mid-1990s, in the late 1990s. And it was a very traditional comet shape, but it was quite far away from us. If we were closer, we would have seen a lot more pulsating activity. We would have seen a lot more activity, possibly where it was creating electrical discharges to asteroids or objects in its vicinity. It would have been much more dynamic than what we saw at the great distance. In fact, Hale-Bopp never really came much closer to us than the same exact distance that we are from the sun. So it was quite far away in the solar system. But if we ever encountered a comet close range, a very large comet, the size of Hale-Bopp or larger, you have to understand that the tail across the middle could be as much as a million miles. Here's little Earth, 8,000 miles across. We're moving around the sun in our orbit. And we could pass through one of these comet tails, and it would take us months, possibly weeks, or possibly months to get through the comet tail. And this would be could possibly be without coming close to the nucleus. So let's imagine a comet, a large celestial object coming in, breaks the solar capacitor, becomes a comet. Let's imagine that that nucleus is the size of Earth. This is getting back to our examples, the gravitational examples. Now I'm adding to that gravitational structure that you learned, I'm adding the comet tail. If we just simply pass through that comet tail, we would be experiencing electrical discharges, the weather that we would experience, probably a lot of high wind. But the biggest thing we would start to experience is a large influx of water. Comet tails are primarily made up of water. These tails are constructed when the hydrogen and oxygen atoms in the solar system are brought together under electrical forces as they're brought into the tail area of the comet. And under electrical forces, they are collide and become water, give off a tremendous amount of heat. And this would be one of the primary components, chemical components, of a comet tail. Also, hydrocarbons, oil, the various types of everything from the ethanol, the smaller molecular chains, up to the very heavy, what we call crude oil and tar, would come into the atmosphere. And with the oxygen, as it met the oxygen in the atmosphere, and the tremendous heating and the electrical discharges, it would ignite what the ancients called naphtha, burning naphtha. And it was very clear they talked about this coming into the upper atmosphere during the Great Flood. So the Earth passing through one of these large tails, we would have a severe pollution event, and it could last for weeks, it could last for months. We know from the ancient texts that the Great Flood, the torrential rains of the Great Flood, lasted for 40 days and 40 nights. So that is a extremely long time for the Earth to weather that kind of, well, the high winds. And then at that time, the nucleus of that comet came quite close to Earth, created a pole shift. We know that the old North Pole moved from where it was to the region north of the state of Michigan. There was a bit of mountain building. We know from the ancients that the seas of the earth rose up and washed over the land, washing them basically clean. And so the volcanoes went off. This is something I've done statistically, and this would be a good high school or college geology project, is to take the cycles, the rhythmic cycles of the volcanic eruptions of all the various volcanoes in the world, And some of them are 10 years, some of them are 50 years, some are 75 years, some of them are hundreds of years and even thousands of years. But if you took all of those cycles and went back in time, they would all converge on the epoch when the mastodons, the saber-toothed tigers, etc., went extinct. That was a time when Earth was barraged by a large comet, and that was the time also of the Great Flood. The history prior to that is very clear. Earth was a well-developed planet, large civilizations, and much of the population of Earth went under. There was a great mass extinction. Man did survive that event, and in fact, it took us about 3,000 to 4,000 years to get back to what we might call modern developed societies. And we have a lot of the information that carried through. Oddly enough, the interest on money and the phony money banking system was in use prior to then and was actually outlawed. So I talk about that. It's very interesting to see the history of man and the laws that were generated back then that now have been put asunder, and you know, now we're seeing the same basically with the banking rules that they're using today with interest on phony money, worthless money. All of that was illegal back before the great catastrophe. But at any rate, if we spent a month going through a comet tail, the other thing that would happen besides severe weather, flooding, burning naphtha, pollution with the hydrocarbons, the very foul air, very difficult to breathe, the other thing that would happen is Earth would lose its sunlight. We would be cast into a shadow that would last for that long, and as the water came in, it would start to glaciate, form glaciers all over the world, and then as Earth passed out of that comet tail, we would begin the very slow cycle back to normal, what we might call normal. And it turns out that Earth has been in the past, especially we know this from the dinosaur era, that Earth has been a tropical climate. It had a tropical climate almost from pole to pole. In other words, we didn't have the frigid zones at the North and South Pole that we have today. And the reason for that is the Earth was not tilted. We have the 23.5 degree tilt of the Earth now, which puts that part of the planet in darkness for weeks, if not months at a time. And so it allows that area to be capped or glaciated for the entire year. Then as that area moves into summer, whether it's the northern cap or the southern polar cap, as those areas move into summer, then they warm up and melt. And of course now the people who study, the hydrologists who study the cycles of water at the North and South Pole, are saying that the Earth is in danger of losing its permanent ice cap, that they would actually go away or significantly go away during the summer months. But you have to understand, this is the normal condition of Earth. And we are just getting back to normal. So what we call global warming is really a natural condition. It is, I've talked about this extensively in my weather book. And as long as I brought that up, I'm going to also refer to the weather book. Page 120, the Principia Meteorologia, Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, I start to list a number of charts, many pages of charts dealing with an extinction event or a close encounter. It's a hypothetical example. It says, the Earth changes caused by a large, highly charged comet nucleus and its large tail passage. And I make the emphasis that this is not a small comet like Halley's or even a medium-sized comet like Hale-Bopp. This would be a very large comet like Venus or an even larger comet. So I give tables on volcanic and earthquake activity before and after the event, ocean water levels, worldwide glaciation, let's see, some of the other tables, atmospheric loss, oil reserves, the mean global temperature, and that's the one I wanted to get to because as we come out of that comet tail, the temperature drops and is very slow to recover. And then at the end of the cycle, which in this case took thousands of years as the glacier started to melt and the Earth started to absorb more heat, light from the sun, because the glaciers were not there reflecting the sunlight, the mean global temperature would increase fairly rapidly and then plateau. So we actually will eventually plateau. The global temperature of Earth will plateau and probably significantly higher than what it is today. These are all natural results of coming out of an encounter with a large celestial object. Now, why am I talking about this? Because I'm trying to educate the public on the reality of what Earth has gone through hundreds, possibly even thousands of times. So I want to talk about, for example, the various types of extinction events. If the object is big and comes by fast and relatively close, say it's much bigger than Earth, and it comes by fast, you would tend to have a lot of mountain building. You would tend to have very devastating tidal waves, tsunamis. You would have a significant amount of volcanic activity and possibly a loss of part of our atmosphere. And the end result, the glaciation would not be that serious because of how fast the object passed in the short amount of time that Earth would be in the comet tail. So let's compare that to an object that comes by fairly slow. In that case, the mountain building would tend to be less. The devastation due to gravitational effects would be less. But the deep freeze, the glaciation, the long-term effects of the deep freeze would be much greater because we would spend much more time in the comet tail. So you have to understand that some of these effects are greater depending on certain factors or parameters. Some of the effects are less. And you have to put all of these together. Now, if there were a specific event that we were looking at, for example, the Venus event. I've already talked about Venus being slightly smaller than Earth. Its surface gravity is less than Earth. So we had a very large pollution event. We know from history that it took us about 40 days to work our way through that comet tail. When we came out the other side, there had been torrential rains. Tidal waves had washed across the land. And just about the entire population of the world, the human population, had been eradicated. And this is what we're seeing now. We see cities that are under the water. We see the coastal shelves. For example, if you look at an underwater map of the eastern United States around Florida, around through the Caribbean, through the Gulf of Mexico, if you look at the island of Cuba, and then for example, Yucatan and down the east coast towards Belize. If you look at offshore, what you find is a vast continental shelf off of all of these regions. And so it's very likely that there were high population regions in all of those zones, especially if you look right at the edge of the continental shelf where it drops off. I'm sure that if you could explore out there, many cases it's only a few hundred feet deep, that you would find cities dotting those coastlines of the continental shelf. And as the last great flood occurred. Of course, the water level came up a couple hundred feet as the North Polar Cap, which had been moved about 20 degrees as it melted, and as the old South Polar Cap melted, that also increased the ocean levels, flooding probably 95% of the populated areas of the world, because we know that just like today, probably about 95% of the world's population today lives within a few miles of the coastlines. And so if there were events like this today, for example, I was just talking to someone about the earthquake in the Puerto Rican Trench, that if there were ever a very severe earthquake there, then the tsunami that would result could be as far as Florida and the eastern coast of the United States within a matter of hours, and people simply would not have time to get up and leave. They would just simply be, that whole peninsula of Florida could be washed over with a great tsunami in a single afternoon. So at any rate, these are the kind of things that have happened historically. We look at some of the great volcanic eruptions that occurred in modern times, Krakatoa and some of the other ones, where we know that island populations that were in the vicinity were devastated with the pyroclastic blast and also the tsunamis that resulted as those volcanoes exploded and the mass movement and air movement caused a great amount of damage locally in that part of the earth. But with something like a comet coming by, this would be very universal. Excuse me. Now, there are probably some people who think, well, we could build spacecraft and go into orbit around Earth and be safe. And really, that is not the case, because if this kind of an object came by Earth, the electrical discharges to those free-floating space objects would be so severe that they would basically be fried right out of the sky, so to speak. The only, and this is why I'm working on certain plans for spacecraft and space colonies, because the only safe place to be in the solar system when such an object came through would be to distribute the population widely throughout outer space. And this would be on many colonies. Some of those colonies would survive through the devastation, and therefore could eventually repopulate parts of the solar system. Apparently we lost connection there. I'm back on the air now, I understand. So I'll try and retrace my steps here, because I think we lost the connection a number of minutes ago. I was talking about the fact that the populations of the world lived around coastal areas, and it is clear from the legends that have been passed down that the oceans washed over the land that probably about 95% of the world's population during that last great catastrophe were washed away with the tsunamis, the resulting tsunamis. I was talking about modern volcanic eruptions like Krakatoa, where we know that nearby islands were very severely affected. But in the case of the ancient, the comets coming by, the effect would have been worldwide. So it's quite amazing, it's quite a tribute to mankind that he survived this this last great catastrophe. And when you read the Colburn, it's very clear that effects, the people who lived through this were very, let's say, shaken. Let's put it that way. And of course, during this entire time, water was something that was plentiful, but it was very polluted. And of course, that's why I sell water filters. It's the one thing in any kind of an emergency that you need. That's the one thing that in any type of man-made or natural disaster, the very first thing you need is water. And in many cases, there's plenty of water around, as in the Iowa flooding, but it was very polluted. So at any rate, having your own personal emergency water filter is something that I just find it as a requirement today. It's not an option. If you care about your loved ones, and it can hit any place. We look at disasters as they in flooding areas around the country, whether it was in Texas or in the upper Midwest, or whether it was Iowa, whether it's out on the West Coast and Oregon and Washington states when it during some heavy rainfall, or along the South Carolina coast. We've seen this kind of flooding every place where people live, and the one thing that they always need is fresh water. And the one thing that is most difficult to get is fresh water, and it's actually the simplest thing if you have your own personal water filter. At any rate, I want to talk about the electrical effects inside the tail of a comet, and to do this, I'm going to refer to a comet called Hale-Bopp that was here in the mid-1990s. We have some pictures that were taken with what was called a Swan filter. And it's a type of filter you use on a telescope, and it filters out everything except the ionized water molecules. And what was discovered was the comet had filament-like tails of water instead of being this large coma that was very smooth and symmetrical. These were almost like lashing snakes coming off of the comet nucleus. At one point, we counted as many as 14 of them. And so at any rate, the comet had many large comet tails, snake-like tails, and these were whipping around. If you took the various photographs that were taken, like time-lapse photography, you could see these vast tails whipping around as they flowed into the comet nucleus. So say you imagine you were in Earth, passing through this comet tail, you would hit these concentrated areas of water, and that would just come pouring into Earth. So it would be like almost like in spasms, where it would just come pouring in and maybe subside just a little bit for a day and then come pouring in again at just unbelievable rates, like, as I said, torrential rain that was the kind of rain you just cannot even imagine, where everything is simply washed away. And that's why also it's very difficult sometimes for geologists and scientists to imagine these types of things when they don't believe in this type of celestial activity. If they think that comets are little dirty snowballs and that they could never affect anything, they don't believe that Earth has ever been affected by a large celestial object ever in its history. So how could you have any truth come out of geology or evolutionary biology or astronomy when they don't recognize the major forces and sources of energy that have formed this planet? They don't even recognize them. And that's why a lot of people listen to this show. That's why a lot of scientists do. And I know there's a lot of scientists who sit back in their room knowing that I'm absolutely correct, but can't say anything because their grant funding would be affected. They like their paychecks, their government-supported paychecks. But little by little, they try and incorporate what I'm doing into their work. But it's very distorted because they're still talking about dirty snowballs instead of really understanding what a comet really is, how a comet really works. And so at any rate, let's look at some electrical effects just before I close out this time, and I'll probably go one more show next week as I close out these various topics dealing with the effects of large celestial objects. Now, part of the cometary structure is the fact that it is discharging electrically the solar capacitor. So you have large electrical currents that are passing through the comet. And once you get close enough, once you're in the comet coma, then the electrical effects can take over and cause electrical discharges. So you know that when, for example, I mentioned this in a previous show, when Moses was standing at the Red Sea, they looked up and saw a vast tornado, a whirlwind that went up into the heavens. And from my weather work, you know that hurricanes and tornadoes are caused by electrical discharges, electrical currents that come down to the troposphere, the weather systems of our around the lower atmosphere. These are electrical discharges from the ionosphere that charge and power these vast storms. So if a comet is coming by and we get within that electrical shielding sheath that is the comet tail, then all of a sudden the comet nucleus can start to discharge to Earth, which is at a different electrical potential. Now, the fact that Moses saw this as he brought the Israelites out of Egypt, and this was recorded in many of the ancient texts. The Colburn talks specifically about it. They talk about the whirlwinds that were about the earth. These are caused by the vast electrical discharges that come down to earth. I also talked about the fact that these electrical discharges could burn the surface of the earth, and if they stayed in one place long enough, could create a burn significant enough to create a volcano. So a number of the volcanoes, for example, on the surface of Mars, are burn volcanoes, not just naturally occurring volcanoes. I mentioned that the recent pictures of the planet Mercury, that when you see large crater-type structures, there's also a line of a dotted line of activity that went through that major crater and continued on. These are the electrical discharges. When I was doing analyzing pictures back at Cornell, 1979, 1980, I discovered one of the first interplanetary electrical discharges that had ever been recorded. It was on the moon Callisto of Jupiter. It was a very nice concentric set of rings with a burn right in the middle, and you could tell that the ring structure was similar to iron-type structures. A simple laboratory experiment where you run a wire with a current through it, through a table, and on that table you put a piece of paper and some iron filings, and those iron filings will structure themselves in concentric circles around the wire because they're adjusting to the magnetic field. These are electrical effects that occur. You'll find that places on the Earth have localized magnetic field structures that are different from the general magnetic field structure that is in the mantle or the surface of the Earth. These are caused when localized magnetic effects take place, and what has to happen is the iron or nickel melts and then solidifies in a different magnetic field, a magnetic field that is not from that normal location. And so the end result is that we find magnetic anomalies all over Earth. The reason for that, one of the reasons, is because of the electrical discharges that come from the comets as they pass through. And as I said, this has happened hundreds, if not thousands, of times. And you can see the magnetic anomalies all over Earth. Now, the other thing that the ancients saw were the lightning bolts that came from various planets. And, of course, this was always thought to be a myth or mythology by standard science until, it was probably about 1997, when the military actually measured a very vast electron beam that came to Earth from the planet Jupiter, and it was very identifiable. And then the people, at least up in the higher tiers of science, tier one science, began to understand that there was something electrical connecting the planets. And as I've said before, of course, in my weather work, when I deal with weather predictions, I talk about the electrical alignment of the planets. And the reason for that is because when the electrical discharges that pass through the individual planets like Earth or Mars, Jupiter or Saturn, when these align, all of a sudden the electrical currents that are passing through the solar system add together and become much greater. So when we align, for example, remember Comet Holmes and the various electrical alignments that occurred there? Remember the Christmas hurricane last year that I predicted? And it hit right on schedule. A lot of this has to do with the electrical alignments in the solar system of the various planets. And a comet, remember, is on an elliptical orbit and is the discharge of the solar capacitor through a comet is far greater than it is with the than it is for the planets. So the end result is that a comet encounter electrically is far more damaging than a planetary encounter, say when Earth and Mars or Earth and Venus form an electrical alignment in their current orbits. And especially if we come extremely close to a comet or get inside that sheath, that's when the large-scale electrical discharges start to take place. So I want to also mention that Hale-Bopp, back in the 1990s, never came very close to Earth, but it spent a number of years directly pumping up the energy of the sun, which then affected our weather. We had a lot of severe weather during that epoch, and it was due to action at a distance, even though Hale-Bopp was never very near. And those effects actually lasted up well into the 2000, early 2000, 2001, 2002. So I'm just about out of time this week. Join me next week as I give the final presentation of the topics dealing with large celestial objects passing near an Earth-like planet in the solar system. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.